You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey, y'all. This is Mark. Thanks for tuning in, and welcome to episode 11. I hope you enjoyed the last show about family-friendly things to do in New Orleans. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. There's plenty in that show for everyone, whether you have children or not. Before we get into today's topic, I want to say thanks to those who left me a review on iTunes. We're up to 57 reviews now. Let's see. Thanks to Scotty Gal, who writes, "Love, love, love your podcast. I'm totally addicted. My father came from Louisiana, so I think it runs in my blood. Totally into the vibe, music, food, history, people, etc." Me too, by the way. She goes on to ask about whether I could release shows weekly, inquires about a Mardi Gras Indian episode, and asks about the filming of the HBO series Tremé as a possible episode topic. Wow. Thanks, Linda. Let's see. I'd love to go to weekly. I just started getting some help with the research to see if that can help me get ahead. I love to do the show, but I'd need to get 3 or 4 episodes ahead before I'd feel comfortable going to weekly. As it is, I spend about 20 hours per show from the point of the idea to when I actually hit publish. It's something I want to do at some point if there's a demand for it, and I'll count you in that number based on your review. The Mardi Gras Indian show is one of the most requested so far, and good news, we're working on it. Look for that one in the near future. I do like your idea of something about the Tremé series, too, and I'll see what I can do. I know several of the central characters, so that might be possible. Thanks to Suzanne, who also mentions Mardi Gras Indians, and points out the Lagniappe at the end of the Mardi Gras episode. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go back to episode 4 and listen past the closing music. Thanks to Mark Roman Bravo. Wow, nice detailed reviews this week. Mark writes, "Your podcast is one of the most consistently great podcasts I listen to. You have a way of organizing so much detail without being persnickety or boring. Thanks for not skimping on those details. Thanks also for actually writing your podcast so you speak in complete sentences without rambling to go off topic. Your podcast has quickly moved to the top of my list of must-listen podcasts." Thanks so much for that, Mark. I really appreciate it. A couple thoughts before we jump into today's subject. I read these reviews because they mean so much to me. For one, good reviews are the best way to attract more listeners. Second, these reviews provide me with incredibly useful feedback, both about how I produce the show and what content I deliver to you. This is critically important to me. It lets me know that I'm meeting your expectations. Thanks so much. Now, on to the show. In today's episode, we tackle the things New Orleanians say, a dictionary and pronunciation guide, if you will, for the Crescent City. This will help you get a flavor of the city, learn a little about the history, and know what you're getting into when you come for a visit. So let's get started. Well, where does our language come from? New Orleans owes its colorful language to the mix of cultures that make New Orleans what it is. French, Spanish, African, Creole, Cajun, the people of Nova Scotia, of Haiti, and the Caribbean as a whole. We're influenced by our colonial roots, the slave trade, our food, and of course our music. As I put this episode together, I realized the uniqueness of the language of New Orleans crosses many different topics, including the places, the food, everyday items, colors, and certainly Mardi Gras and more. In fact, I covered many of the terms unique to Mardi Gras in episodes 3 and 4. Number 3 was about Carnival, and 4 was the Mardi Gras Survival Guide. Go back and give them a listen, even though Carnival 2017 is a long ways off. You'll pick up lots of history and knowledge about Carnival and the language associated with Mardi Gras in New Orleans. Today, I thought we'd cover some of the items that hit the intersection of commonly used in New Orleans and unique and interesting. So you'll hear these things frequently in New Orleans, and maybe not have heard them in other places. Or you might have heard of them, but weren't quite sure what they meant or why they were used. As I was putting the show together, I realized there are enough unique words and colloquialisms in New Orleans for more than one episode. In fact, this may either become an occasional series within the podcast, or perhaps a segment of the show. We'll see what you think of this one. Let's jump into the language in New Orleans. The word Lagniappe is a good starting point on our journey through the verbal landscape of New Orleans. Lagniappe is one of my favorite New Orleans words, not only because of what it means, but because of its origin, and specifically that it brings together so many New Orleans influences all in one word. In New Orleans, it means a little something extra. Mark Twain refers to Lagniappe as a word worth traveling to New Orleans to get in his book Life on the Mississippi. The word entered English from the Louisiana French who adapted a Quechua word brought into New Orleans by the Spanish Creoles. It derived from the South American Spanish phrase la yapa or ñapa, referring to a free extra item, usually a very cheap one. And, just to tie it into New Orleans' Catholic heritage, Quechua was the language used by the Roman Catholic missionaries in Central America after the Spanish conquest in the 16th century. On this podcast, it means an extra tip, a historical note, or an additional piece of information, something you weren't expecting but hopefully will appreciate and enjoy. At dinner, it's the New Orleans equivalent of an amuse-bouche, though it might be offered at the end of the meal. As a kid, I'd frequently go to the French market with my mom or dad to purchase cases of fresh vegetables for our restaurant. The vendors would almost always offer an extra piece of fruit for me to eat, or sometimes another few tomatoes, a few heads of lettuce, you know, Lagniappe. Now, let's talk about New Orleans itself. New Orleans is pronounced New Orleans, like I pronounce it, or New Orleans by locals. Almost never New Orleans, and definitely not Nawlins. One exception, the late Frank Davis, a local TV personality, a sportsman, a cook, an all-around great guy, used to have a segment on the local news called Naturally Nawlins. Frank could get away with it, but you shouldn't try. In addition to the name of my hometown, we have several nicknames for the city. Big Easy refers to the laid-back vibe of the city. Crescent City is a nod to the bend in the river against which the city of New Orleans was established in 1718. Incidentally, we just celebrated the 298th birthday of the city on May 7th, just a couple days before I record this. New Orleans is also referred to as the city that Care forgot. The meaning appears to be lost to history, but the term was first used in the 1930s. And of course, New Orleans is often referred to as NOLA, short for New Orleans, Louisiana. In fact, we have a cat named Nola. She was named for the city long before we returned home during our time as expats when we lived in Northern Virginia and worked in D.C. Another essential and unique New Orleans term is neutral ground. It's a median in most parts of the United States, but not in New Orleans. Any discussion of the neutral ground must first start with Canal Street. Its name refers to plans for a canal that would connect the Mississippi River with Lake Pontchartrain. Those plans were abandoned, though, and the canal was never dug. Today, Canal Street is a major thoroughfare in the city and is one boundary of the French Quarter. It has three lanes in each direction and a wide space in the middle where the streetcar tracks and the buses are today. Canal Street separates the French Quarter from the Central Business District, or the area of the city known as the American Sector in the early 1800s. Back then, the French Quarter was populated by the Creoles, while Americans, largely from the Midwest, moved to the city and lived uptown. Since the street and the canal were going to be in between the two distinct populations, the middle ground became known as the neutral ground, almost certainly a nod to the cultural divide. While the canal never came to be, the phrase neutral ground stuck, and eventually neutral ground became the accepted term for any median in New Orleans. And here's a little Lagniappe. During Mardi Gras, you'll hear sides of the parade referred to as either the sidewalk side or the neutral ground side, as in, I'm riding in Endymion, 16th Float, sidewalk side. Or, I'll see you at the parades tonight on the corner of Napoleon and St. Charles. I'll be on the neutral ground side. You can even get t-shirts that say sidewalk side or neutral ground. Next up, let's talk about the counties that aren't. In Louisiana, we don't have counties. We have parishes. You probably knew that, but you ever wondered why? Well, Louisiana was officially Roman Catholic under both Spanish and French rule. Boundaries separating territories generally matched church parishes. In 1807, the Louisiana legislature formally adopted the term parish, and it's been that way ever since. In 1816, the first official map of the state used the term parish, as did the 1845 Constitution. Since then, the official term for Louisiana's primary civil divisions has been parishes. We have 64 of them today, including Orleans, which encompasses New Orleans, and was named after the Duke of Orléans, the Regent of France. We have one parish, Chalmette, that is also lovingly referred to as the parish. People who grow up in Chalmette, just downriver from the French Quarter by a couple miles, have a unique dialect and are known locally as Yats, as in, where you at, darling? They are honored and imitated in song, in speech, and even in cartoons. Heck, I could do a whole show on Yat Speak, but we'll leave it there for the moment. My favorite parish name is Evangeline, named for the Acadian heroine of Henry Longfellow Wadsworth's poem, Evangeline. I tried to get my wife to name one of our girls Evangeline, but I was unsuccessful. Oh well, I guess the names Olivia and Sophia worked out pretty well. Let's move on to our next topic, shall we? How about shotgun houses? These are part of the architectural identity in New Orleans. The term refers to a narrow rectangular house with rooms one behind the other and doors at the other end, or at either end, excuse me. Usually the houses are no more than 12 feet wide, and the name shotgun refers to the idea of being able to fire a shotgun blast through the front door and have the shot travel all the way through without hitting a wall. The shotgun was the most popular style of house in the southern U.S. from the end of the Civil War until the 1920s. And one variation, at least in New Orleans, is the camelback, which has a second-story addition near the back half of the house. The origins of the shotgun style are somewhat murky. Some suggest that they originated in the Creole faubourgs of New Orleans in the early 1800s, while others suggest the shotgun house has its origins in Haiti. In any event, there were definitely shotgun houses present in New Orleans by the 1830s, if not earlier. Usually, the front room is a small living room or parlor, followed by one or two bedrooms. The kitchen is usually the last room in the house, and the style predates indoor plumbing, so bathrooms were added on, usually as an offset to the kitchen or sometimes just in front of the kitchen. Today, if you look for it, you can often see the addition added onto the kitchen to add a bathroom on the back. The houses have small front porches and are typically close to the street with little or no front yard. The setup also allows good airflow, which is another reason for the original design with the doors all lined up. Additionally, shotgun houses in New Orleans are raised slightly, usually 3 or 4 feet off the ground. This feature also helps with air circulation. Another variation is the double shotgun, which is essentially two houses under one roof that share a center wall. You'll also see double shotguns that have been renovated and are now the residence of a single family. You can find examples of shotgun houses throughout New Orleans, ranging from the very small and simple to fairly elaborate and quite large, especially if doubles have been converted into one residence and they have a camelback. By the way, faubourg is a word I used a moment ago, so we should talk about that now. Faubourg is an old French word loosely meaning suburb. In New Orleans, the term faubourg was used to describe the neighborhoods beyond the French Quarter, so not really suburbs in the sense you would think of them. Today, there's 73 areas in the city recognized as neighborhoods. Two of the oldest outside the French Quarter are the Faubourg Marigny and the Faubourg Treme. The Marigny is one of the oldest parts of the city outside the French Quarter. It's just downriver from the quarter and was founded in 1805. It's a popular destination within the city for both entertainment and as a place to live. It includes Frenchman Street, which is lined with live music venues and restaurants. The Marigny also has a unique and colorful architectural style, combining elements of our French, Spanish, and Caribbean, and predominantly Haitian heritage. You'll find cottages, shotgun houses, and bright colors, all with lots of architectural details. The Treme has received attention in recent years due to the popular HBO series of the same name. The Treme is one of the oldest neighborhoods in New Orleans and is considered the oldest African-American neighborhood in the United States. It's located just behind the French Quarter once you cross Rampart Street. You can often see second-line parades and jazz funerals in the Treme. And it also includes Armstrong Park, a tribute to the great Louis Armstrong. And within the park is Congo Square. Congo Square was considered the town center of the Treme and was a gathering place for slaves in the 18th and 19th centuries. It was a place they could go on Sundays to dance, play music, and trade. As you learned in Episode 9, the Jazz Fest show, Congo Square was also the original home of the New Orleans Jazz Fest. Within the confines of Armstrong Park is the Mahalia Jackson Performing Arts Theater, home of the New Orleans Philharmonic, the Opera Association, and hosted numerous Broadway shows and traveling music acts throughout the year. Let's talk about the terms Cajun and Creole now. These are used to refer both to people and to styles of food. Cajuns refer to the French Acadians who were exiled from Nova Scotia by the British for their Catholic beliefs during the French and Indian War. Many settled in Louisiana, and more specifically, along the bayous southwest of New Orleans. This area encompasses 22 parishes today, in an area referred to as Acadiana. The Cajuns were relatively isolated in their new home, but this worked out okay because they were able to use the trapping, hunting, fishing, and pig farming skills they brought with them. Those influences are definitely noticeable in Cajun food today. It tends to be hearty and a bit rustic or country. That's not to say it isn't good. It's great, in fact, just not typically fancy. Creole, on the other hand, is a bit more complicated. The word Creole is derived from the Spanish word criollo, which means native to a place. The term Creole usually refers to city people, and traditionally in New Orleans refers to those of French or Spanish or African or Caribbean ancestry. It also sometimes is used in New Orleans to refer to those of mixed race, or at least historically it was, and or to those of African descent who were born here as opposed to those who came here as slaves. In terms of food, Creole tends to mean French in heritage, but it typically includes influences from several cultures, all part of our heritage. From Spanish cooking, the bell peppers, onions, and celery, known as the Holy Trinity. A close cousin, by the way, is the mirepoix, onions, carrots, and celery. Sicilian immigrants to New Orleans contributed tomatoes, which are integral to so many sauces in New Orleans cuisine. Filet comes from the Native Americans, and okra is African. Both are used as thickeners in our beloved gumbo. Cayenne pepper, ubiquitous to so many New Orleans dishes, is Caribbean. Again, native to a place or a people. You blend this together and you get native to New Orleans. If Creole seems a little fuzzier than Cajun, that's because it is. The differences in the food might seem subtle if you're not from here. For instance, many Cajun and Creole dishes start with a roux, a blend of fat, usually oil or butter, and flour. However, Cajun roux tends to be darker and more intense. It takes longer to prepare. When I make a dark roux for a gumbo, it can take 45 minutes of constant stirring to get just the right color and depth. Creole roux tends to be lighter, though there's exceptions to everything, of course. A Creole roux is sometimes almost blonde, like what you make as a base for an etouffee. You can see and taste the difference in jambalaya, too. Cajun jambalaya is typically brown. The color comes from the bits that are scraped up from the bottom of the cast iron pot while you're cooking. But jambalaya made in the Creole tradition is typically red, thanks to the introduction of the tomato. For the most part, Cajun food was not common in New Orleans until Paul Prudhomme brought it to the city in the 1970s. Today, many chefs carry on the tradition, including Donald Link and his wonderful restaurant in the Warehouse District, Couchant. Incidentally, two of my favorite cookbooks help illustrate the differences. Chef Paul Prudhomme's Louisiana Kitchen cookbook is the epitome of a Cajun cookbook. As a contrast, Richard and Rima Collins' New Orleans cookbook contains many dishes with the same names as those found in Prudhomme's, but the preparation and the ingredients sometimes vary significantly. If you can find these two cookbooks, they'd form a terrific start to any collection about New Orleans and Louisiana cooking in general. Both of mine have numerous stains and marks on them from years of use. I've had the best of both worlds. I was born and raised in New Orleans, and my last name is Bologna. My dad's family is Sicilian, while my mom's is French and German. However, I went to college deep in Acadiana in Lafayette. While it's only 140 miles away from my present home in the heart of New Orleans, I definitely learned the difference between Creole and Cajun. Everything from the food to the music, the dialects, and the cultures. If you get the chance, you should spend some time in Cajun country. In fact, at some point, I think I'll do an episode about day trips or overnight trips from New Orleans, and a couple stops in Acadiana would definitely make that list. Anyway, let's stick with food for a minute. I mentioned roux, but let's run through several other terms you might come across in New Orleans. How about dressed? This refers to how you want your po' boy. Dressed means lettuce, tomatoes, mayonnaise, and pickles. If you're ordering a seafood po' boy, then it also means ketchup and hot sauce. If you ask for mustard, you usually need to specify yellow or Creole, which is sometimes also called hot mustard. Next, let's talk about couchon de lait. You come across this at jazz fest, at school fairs, and certainly in Cajun country. Couchon de lait roughly translates to suckling pig. A couchon de lait generally refers to the roasting of a pig. At Jazz Fest, one of the more popular dishes is a couchon de lait po' boy, shredded roasted pork on po' boy bread. It's delicious. In fact, you can see a picture in my Instagram feed under the name Beyond Bourbon ST. Next up is gumbo yaya, one of my favorites. You've heard me talk about this before if you've listened to past episodes. Gumbo yaya refers to chicken and andouille gumbo. My favorite version can be found at Mr. B's Bistro in the French Quarter. That one has a dark, rich roux, and it's really good, strong andouille in it. Speaking of which, andouille is a smoked pork sausage, usually made with pork butts, fat, salt, black pepper, garlic, smoked over pecan wood. Laplace, Louisiana, which is a town just west of New Orleans, is nicknamed the andouille capital of the world. And you'll find andouille sausage used in many dishes here, including gumbo and jambalaya. Before we move on, any conversation about Mr. B's Bistro must include barbecued shrimp. Barbecued shrimp is a dish actually created at another local restaurant, Pascal's Manali. Despite the name, it doesn't include barbecue sauce. Instead, the dish consists of shrimp sautéed in a sauce of butter, lemon, Worcestershire sauce, garlic, cracked black pepper, and some Creole seasoning. It's typically served with plenty of hot French bread for dipping. And one note, the shrimp are usually served with the heads on and unpeeled. This makes it pretty messy to eat. Some places will remove the shells if you ask, and they'll certainly furnish you with a bib or an extra cloth napkin if you need it. Barbecue shrimp is one of my favorite dishes, and I'm partial to the ones they serve at Mr. B's Bistro. In fact, it's on my last meal menu. You know, the menu I would eat if I knew I only had one dinner left? You never heard of such a thing? Well, you should live in New Orleans. We live to eat here, not eat to live, which is yet another only a New Orleans saying now that I think about it. It's actually more of a lifestyle than a language thing, but I digress. Next up, crawfish. Not crayfish, not crawdads, and almost never mud bugs. Act like a local and call them crawfish. By the way, don't eat the ones whose tails are sticking straight out at a crawfish boil. It means they were dead before they hit the water, which is not a good thing. Besides boiled, you'll find crawfish in gumbo, etouffee, bisque, and other dishes. Sometimes you'll find a fried crawfish tail po' boy. My favorite is a combination of crawfish etouffee with fried crawfish on top, and it's the way I make it at home. Something about the crispiness of the fried crawfish on top of the etouffee makes it extra special. Etouffee refers to a method of cooking meat or seafood by smothering them with vegetables, usually celery, bell peppers, and onions. In New Orleans, the typical etouffee is shrimp or crawfish, and it's served over rice. Similar to gumbo, etouffee is made with a roux, but it's a blonde or light roux, as I described earlier. In contrast, most gumbos are made with a medium to dark roux, and the difference is achieved by the cooking time of the roux. The darker the roux, the more intense the flavor of the dish. Shrimp etouffee typically also includes a tomato-based sauce, while crawfish etouffee doesn't. Let's talk about pecans for a moment. They are not pecans, at least not in New Orleans. Pecans are those portable potties you use at Jazz Fest and Mardi Gras, got it? Nothing will expose you as a visitor quicker than to ask for pecan pie. It's pecan pie, y'all. I can't think about pecans, by the way, without thinking about pralines. The praline was originally a French confection made with sugar and almonds. After their arrival in New Orleans in the mid-1700s, local candy makers quickly substituted native pecans for the almonds. Combined with our plentiful local sugarcane, it was a natural fit. While other places have them, in New Orleans, pralines are most often made with pecans, sugar, and cream. You undoubtedly know about beignets, the popular French-styled fried donuts we love. I talked about them at length in the last episode on family-friendly things to do in New Orleans. However, what about café au lait? Café au lait is coffee and chicory mixed with scalded milk. Chicory is actually a weed with a bitter taste. It was and is used as an extender in coffee, but rather than being seen as a negative, coffee and chicory is very popular in New Orleans. When combined with beignets at Café du Mont or the Morning Call, it makes a perfect pair. The bitterness of the chicory helps offset the sweetness of the powdered sugar on the beignets. Let's head in a different direction, if you will, and talk about geography. I didn't know it when I started Beyond Bourbon Street, but giving you directions on how to get somewhere in New Orleans has been one of my greatest challenges. The problem is that New Orleanians don't use compass directions. Instead, everything is downtown, uptown, by the lake, or by the river. To make it even more confusing, downtown to a New Orleanian really means downriver. So downtown can mean past what you would think of as downtown, or in our case, the central business district. You still with me? In case that isn't confusing enough, you might have noticed the river curves, so towards a river does not imply north, west, east, or south. Ask a New Orleanian for directions, and you'll often get something like this. Go down St. Charles Avenue towards Uptown. The place you want is on the riverside of the street in the Lower Garden District just past the Muses. I just described how to get to Emeril's Delmonico restaurant from the Central Business District. And to some New Orleanians, we add back a town as a direction. To get your head around this, think of the French Quarter, the original footprint of the city. The streets closest to the river are the front of town. The French Quarter ends at Rampart Street in one direction. This is headed towards Lake Pontchartrain. Back of Rampart Street is the Treme, one of the oldest neighborhoods outside the quarter, as we talked about a little while ago. This was considered back of town, right? Back of the French Quarter. Trombone Shorty even named one of his albums Back of Town, since that's where he grew up, in the Treme, behind the city, you know, behind the French Quarter. Of course, as the city expanded, back of town did too. It eventually absorbed Mid-City and Gentilly. It gets confusing because at some point the intersection of uptown and downtown runs into back of town. For our purposes, back of town commonly means the Treme and can include Mid-City. Leave it to us New Orleanians to fight about the further boundaries. All this gets me back to my point about giving you directions. I try to translate in my head as best I can the directions I've grown up with into north, south, east, and west for you. Post-Katrina, we have more transplants, so I hear some people using compass directions, but it's an immediate giveaway that you didn't grow up here. Now, the reverse is also true. I moved from New Orleans to Minnesota years ago, and I had no idea what direction north was when people would tell me to head north to get here or there. My family would tell you I have no sense of direction, no matter whether I'm using a compass, New Orleans directions, or even the GPS on my phone. And they're right. As a result of all this, giving you directions is the hardest part of this podcast. You're welcome, and I love you. Now, I'm on a roll. Imagine sitting on the river across from Jackson Square. You're enjoying a couple pralines you picked up from Aunt Sally's, a block down from Café Du Monde, or maybe a muffalata from Central Grocery on Decatur. In any event, you're sitting there gazing at the river traffic. You notice a point of land out there just a bit to the left across the river. That's Algiers Point. It's over there in the West Bank. What? Yep, the west bank of the river. The French Quarter is on the east bank. Pull out your phone and see what compass direction that is. It's east. In New Orleans, everything south of Lake Pontchartrain is considered to be on the east bank of the river, while anything south of the lake and on the other side of the river is considered to be the west bank. I know, you probably need a break. Let's do some easy stuff before we talk about street names. Oh, I know, let's talk about go-cups. You could probably use one about now. A go-cup refers to a plastic cup given to patrons as they leave a bar in New Orleans. New Orleans allows open containers. That is, you can walk around town with an open container and drink alcohol, as long as it isn't in a glass bottle. As a result, if you want to leave a bar and finish your drink on the street, just ask for a go-cup. A go-cup is also the term locals use to describe the plastic cups you catch as throws during Mardi Gras. In fact, my water right here is in a go-cup right now. Those cups tend to be made of a sturdier plastic than what you get when you leave in a bar. Nonetheless, they serve the same purpose. We have dozens of them at the house, and everyone here does. My kids know when we go out for a walk, somebody needs to grab a go-cup so Dad can put his beer in it. And they sometimes even ask for a go-cup for their juice. Locals use these cups for all sorts of things. They make great paint cups when doing touch-up work, and they're good pen and pencil holders, too. I keep some in the car during Jazz Fest so we can drink a beer on the walk from the car to the gates of the fairgrounds. And I'm not alone on this one, not by a long shot. Go-cups provide a nice segue to Mardi Gras. As I mentioned earlier, if you want to deep dive into Mardi Gras and Carnival, check out episodes 3 and 4 of the podcast. For today's purposes, however, let's cover some of the terms. First, Carnival. Carnival is the season. It begins on Twelfth Night, January 6th, also known as the Feast of the Epiphany, and it concludes on Mardi Gras Day. The date of Mardi Gras varies based on the date of Easter Sunday, so the length of carnival season can vary. This year, we had a short carnival, with Mardi Gras on February 9th. In 2017, Mardi Gras is February 28th, so we get an additional 3 weeks of revelry and king cakes. The phrase Mardi Gras is French and means Fat Tuesday, so compared to the season of carnival, it's a single day. Parades are held by carnival organizations called crews. It's spelled K-R-E-W-E. It's widely believed use of this spelling and term was coined by New Orleans' oldest carnival organization, the Mystic Crew of Comus, which held its first procession through the city in 1857. In the days before streetlights, Mardi Gras parades were illuminated by torches known as flambeaux, spelled F-L-A-M-B-E-A-U-X. traditionally carried by African-American men who would march alongside the floats and were known to dance and entertain the revelers along the way. Many parades continue the tradition today, even though there's plenty of light along the streets and on the floats themselves. Masked riders toss throws to the crowd who are watching along the route, making Mardi Gras parades simply the best in the world, especially if you're a kid or young at heart. These throws may include plastic or glass beads, stuffed animals, trinkets, specialty throws with the insignia of the carnival crew, including the go-cups we just talked about, and doubloons. Doubloons are coins minted specifically for each organization. On one side will be the name and symbol of the crew. On the reverse will be a detailed scene and a description of that year's theme for the parade. Doubloons are usually made of anodized aluminum, though some are made of wood, and occasionally collector's versions are made of more precious metals like silver. The colors of Mardi Gras are purple, green, and gold, which were established by Rex, which first appeared on the carnival scene in 1872. Rex is French for king, of course, and the man who reigns as Rex each year is said to be the king of carnival. Likewise, his queen is known as the queen of carnival. Each year, the mayor of New Orleans ceremoniously hands over the keys to the city to Rex, then greets him along the route with a toast of champagne. The king may reign over the parade and ride on the first float, but the real leader is the captain. He's the chief operating officer, if you will. In some crews, the captain rides on a horse at the front of the procession. He usually wears an all-white costume and is typically masked. The place where Mardi Gras floats are housed is called the den. Some organizations offer tours, and if you're in town and have the chance, this is worth checking out. In the last episode, we talked about Mardi Gras World. A visit there would give you a sense of what a den looks like as well. The boeuf gras, or fatted ox, is another Rex tradition. At one time, an actual ox was included in the parade. These days, a float with a large papier-mâché bull takes its place. You know it's Mardi Gras when you've seen Rex followed by that float with the bull, complete with steam extruding from his nostrils. King cake is another topic we cover extensively in the carnival episode. King cake is made of braided Danish pastry dough and is eaten in great quantities during carnival. Inside the cake is a plastic baby or other small favor. The person who finds the baby inside their piece buys the next cake. The last word or phrase I'll mention today related to Mardi Gras are the Mardi Gras Indians. Look for a future episode on this topic, but the Indians are tribes of African-American New Orleanians who wear elaborate hand-sewn suits of beads and feathers. They parade on Mardi Gras morning through the neighborhoods and streets, looking for other tribes in order to see whose big chief is the prettiest. Okay, enough with Mardi Gras for now. Go back and listen to the earlier shows to get more details, and be on the lookout for the Mardi Gras Indian show coming soon. Let's see, what else can confuse you or out you as a tourist? Streetcars. We have streetcars in New Orleans. We don't have trolleys or cable cars. In fact, the St. Charles Streetcar Line began operation in 1835 and is the oldest continuously running streetcar line in the world. Today, we're seeing a resurgence in streetcar lines in New Orleans. New lines are being developed all over the city, or at least it feels that way. Streetcars are a topic unto themselves, and they'll be the subject of a future episode. Just know they come in red or green. Green for the St. Charles line, and red for both the Canal Street and the Riverside lines. You can call them the St. Charles or Canal lines. You can refer to them by their colors, red or green. Just don't call them trolleys, okay? Hey, here's another thing. You know that inspection sticker on your car? Well, these days they're called inspection stickers here too, but for most of my life, they were brake tags. And that's what most locals who've been here a while still call them, brake tags. It used to be you had to go to a brake tag station and wait in a really long line to get one. Fortunately, you can now get them at many local gas stations, but the name remains. Oh, let's talk about colors. Two in particular that you'll hear locals refer to. Wander through the French Quarter for 3 minutes and you'll come across shutters painted a deep green. It's got its own name, French Quarter Green. Go to a paint store in New Orleans, like Helm Paint, and ask for French Quarter Green. They'll know how to mix it. You'll also hear locals refer to K&B Purple. K&B is a now defunct local drugstore chain. Their colors included a very distinct purple. Natives still lovingly refer to a certain shade of purple as K&B Purple. You don't want to go to a paint store and ask for that. They might mix it for you, but you don't want to paint anything with it, not unless you really want to stand out. The one exception might be the parade ladders, the top of the parade ladders anyway, where the kids sit. If you wander uptown and take a tour of the Garden District, you'll likely come across fountains bubbling out of large pots. In most cases, those pots are cast iron sugar kettles. The sugarcane industry was formed in Louisiana in the mid-1750s. As part of the process, the cane is harvested, then crushed to extract the juice. The juice then needed to be cooked down to produce sugar or cane syrup, whichever was desired. These pots were also often used on plantations to cook large batches of food like gumbo and jambalaya. You'll see them around town today in use as fountains. Another word you'll come across is pirogue. It's pronounced piro or pirogue, and it's spelled P-I-R-O-G-U-E. A pirogue is basically the Cajun version of a canoe. Traditionally, it was made out of hollowed cypress logs. Today, they usually have flat bottoms for easy navigation in the shallow waters of the marsh and swamps, and are often made of wood or fiberglass. Growing up, we used pirogues to set our crawfish nets in shallow water. They're easy to turn over and dump out if water gets in them, and the pirogue can be carried pretty easily, which is useful, since we'd often run into areas that are not navigable in the boat. You'll also sometimes find them used at crawfish boils. The boil master will dump a pot of freshly boiled crawfish and vegetables right into a pirogue, usually set up on top of some sawhorses or maybe a table. Guests can then reach in and help themselves. You probably heard of a second line, right? But do you know what they are? A second line basically means the line of followers that join in behind the official parade or procession. Today you'll see the second line waving handkerchiefs or twirling small umbrellas. Second lines have their roots in the social aid organizations that were formed after the Civil War to help the newly freed slaves. These groups often provided basic insurance, loans, and burial needs for its members. They'd also hold funeral processions to honor their members. And they held parades as a way of introducing the community to their services, a kind of live advertisement, if you will. Today, you can still find second lines in the city as funeral processions, sometimes with a casket and sometimes not. In fact, there have been second lines for Alan Toussaint, David Bowie, and Prince. Second lines these days are also held sometimes just for the heck of it, parades just a parade. On weekend nights in the French Quarter, you'll see a second line organized as part of a wedding. Guests will follow the newly married couple from the site of the ceremony to the reception. A couple things define a modern second line. First and foremost, you need a brass band. They'll have some combination of a tuba, trombone, or trumpet, plus a snare or bass drum, and maybe some other instruments. And often you'll see tourists climb in or line up behind them, hence creating the second line. While you're following that second line, you might notice some of our street names. Some are famously difficult to figure out, like Chapatoulas and Treme. But many others we just pronounce differently than you would expect. Here's a brief list to help you out. In the Lower Garden District are streets named for the Muses. We mispronounce nearly all of them, starting with Calio, which is not Calliope. Melpomene, we pronounce it Melpomene. Clio is not Clio, but Clio, or CL10, which is named after the streetcar line whose destination read CL10. It's long gone, but older natives will still call it sometimes CL10. Terpsichore is Terpsichore. We don't stop here, though. You might know Milan as the city in Italy, but here locals pronounce that street as Milan. Burgundy is not like the wine or the region, but rather Burgundy. And Marigny is not Marigny. I could go on, but this is a good starter guide to our streets. We're also fond of things that aren't around anymore. A local musician named Benny Grunch wrote a song called Ain't There No More, listing many of our favorites. There's even a Facebook group some 40,000 strong by the same name. Some of the more common ones you'll hear us talk about include Hubig's Pies. I've mentioned these in a couple episodes. They were fried pies filled with fruit. Lemon were the best, but they also came in apple, coconut, chocolate, sweet potato, and sometimes other varieties. We had these in place of a groom's cake when my wife and I were married in 2009. Instead of the normal label at the top, they were adorned with Mark and Marie and the date, April 3rd, 2009. Unfortunately, the bakery burned down in 2012, and we're all still waiting for it to return. Schwagman's was a local chain of grocery stores that ain't here no more. When people talk about Schwagman bags, they mean brown paper bags. These were also the bag of choice in 1980 when the Saints went 1-15 and the locals called them the Aints. People wore bags over their heads to the football games. And true story here, we made bag heads as a class project in elementary school. I can remember cutting out the eye holes and decorating the bags. Fortunately, the Aints ain't there no more either, though the last couple Saints seasons haven't been the best. We mentioned K&B earlier, the local drugstore chain with a bright purple and white logo. Pontchartrain Beach was an amusement park you'll hear locals talk about that was located at Lake Pontchartrain at the end of Elysian Fields Boulevard in Gentilly. Just a couple miles down the lake in New Orleans East was Lincoln Beach, a similar but smaller park for African Americans before desegregation. Both parks closed long ago, but remnants of each one still remain along the banks of the lake. Work is currently underway to restore the actual beach portion of Pontchartrain Beach. New Orleanians also have our own way of saying things. We don't go to the grocery store to pick up groceries, for instance. Instead, we make groceries. We're also always fixing to do something, you know, as in about to go do it. If someone says, let me ask you something, they aren't about to kill you. Instead, they want to ask you a question. A common greeting is, where you at? And the proper response is, hey, I'm good. Another thing about New Orleans, if someone asks you where you went to school, they mean high school, not college. I've run across the same thing in St. Louis, but not in any other places I can recall. In any event, high school pride runs deep here, and those connections can be as powerful as any fraternity or business association. Very recently, I was eating lunch at Katie's in Mid-City with the alumni director of my high school. A guy walked in and sat next to us at the bar. He had a suitcase with him, and he said he had just come from the airport. He was in town to enjoy Jazz Fest. Over the course of lunch, we chatted with him on and off, and we were frequently interrupted by friends. After a while, he looked at us and asked, "Do you know everybody in here?" Well, the answer was, between the two of us, we knew nearly everyone in the place. It helped that the owner was also a graduate of our high school, but this is the way of New Orleans. All right, I think we're at a good stopping point. I realized as I was preparing for this show that the topic could easily cover several episodes. There's such a wide range of unique terms, expressions, colloquialisms, and oddities about the language in New Orleans. As I mentioned at the top, I might make this an occasional series or a segment of the show. Please let me know what you think about those ideas. Also, just a couple days before recording this one, a new listener and a long-lost friend named Shelley Cannon turned me on to a book called Quaint Essential New Orleans, a Crescent City Lexicon. It's written by a New Orleanian, Kevin Bozant. I reached out to Mr. Bozant, and I'm going to see if I can't get him on a future episode. In the meantime, I've given you enough of a primer for one show. You now got an understanding of how we speak about geography. Importantly, you know how to say Chapatoulas. And believe me, you'll get some instant street cred if you can pull that off. You're an expert on Lagniappe, and you know why we have parishes. You know what a neutral ground is, and you know not to ax where the trolley stop is. You know the basics when it comes to food, and you can tell the difference between an etouffee and a jambalaya. You get the whole go-cup thing, and can't wait to try it out next time you visit. And finally, you know how to answer when someone asks where you went to school. Well, there you have it. Grab all the notes for today's show over at www.beyondbourbonst.com/11. And if you enjoyed the show, please head on over to iTunes and leave us a quick review. It'd mean the world to me. It's quick and easy. Grab your phone now, and I'll walk you through it. If you have an iPhone, tap on the purple podcast button. Search for Beyond Bourbon Street and tap on the podcast artwork. When that comes up, you'll see a selection for reviews. Tap that. Next, you'll see an option for leaving a review. Type in a few words and click on all 5 stars. That's all there is to it. Thanks so much for listening. Our next couple shows are all based on listener requests. We'll cover craft beer next time. In the near future, we got shows coming on Mardi Gras Indians, the Essence Fest, the Garden District, streetcars, and more. We're also working on an idea around holding weddings or other special events in New Orleans, since I get a lot of questions on this topic. I got married here when I was living somewhere else, so I know a good bit about that one. And if you have an idea for a topic, let me know. If you want to hear more shows like this one, please subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. I've also started posting images of New Orleans on Instagram. Search for Beyond Bourbon ST over there. New episodes are available every other Wednesday. And until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.